So good evening. So tonight we'll explore the first noble truth as we've been doing all month and beginning a year-long investigation into the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path with my co-guiding teacher, Tuareg. So the first noble truth, that of dukkha. So the talk we did 2 weeks ago, we focused more on the wisdom side of it, to seeing how if any situation, any object, any experience, any aspect of ourselves has a sense of impermanence, of change, and also has a quality of emptiness of self, that in itself means it's dukkha. Dukkha is this Pali word often translated as suffering, but can also see it as this unsatisfactoriness of experience, and how this becomes the first noble truth, the truth of dukkha, and how it unfolds from there. Now with that sense of anything being impermanent and being empty of self, this is actually a natural part of reality. It's hard to find something that's not that. Okay, so dukkha is actually a very natural experience of life. And as long as we're relating to life in this easy, flowing way, there's no problem. But when we relate to life in a certain way of grasping, of trying to hold on to it, of trying to make it ours, and our happiness is dependent upon it staying, then we experience suffering. We experience dukkha ourselves. So it goes beyond just a simple sense of confusion about how things are to touch some of the deepest pain we experience as human beings, some of the deepest levels of suffering. Now that sense of pain becomes a launching pad for our practice. So this week we're going to go from the wisdom side of things and move instead toward compassion. Because often when we experience pain in ourselves, this is what motivates us to act. You might think about your own practice. How many in the room started practicing because of pain, because of suffering, trying to find some way to go through that, to understand it in a different way. So touching pain, touching suffering can provide that motivation. I mean, this is an ordinary thing that we feel that, get that negative test result from the doctor, that motivates us to finally take care of ourselves. When we hit bottom, that's when we start to really look at ourselves in a different way. So the rub, though, is that when we touch pain without the it provides a lot of motivation to act, to do something about. But if you don't touch and see that clearly enough, it distorts how our actions flow from that. Our actions are distorted because we're not sure about what the cause is. We know we're suffering. We know we have discomfort we want to escape from. We want to be free of that. And so we start to find some way. But if you don't clearly see that cause of that, really see the suffering itself, we become very reactive. As humans don't like pain, we rush to fix it. If you don't see the problem clearly, then our actions are misdirected. This is really this Four Noble Truths. It's touching in clearly on the aspect of dukkha, of suffering, and next month Tuareg will explore the cause of dukkha, the origination of dukkha, and the cessation of dukkha the month after that. And then the rest of the year we'll explore the path to the end of dukkha. So this sense of being confused about what the cause is and trying to find it and how we get frantic, there's a story that Ajahn Chah told of the Buddha. That the Buddha once saw a jackal, a wild dog, run out of the forest where he was staying. It stood still for a while, then it ran into the underbrush, and then out again. Then it ran into a tree hollow, then out again. It went into a cave, only to run out again. One minute it stood, the next it ran. Then it lay down, then it jumped up. The jackal had the mange. When it stood, the mange would eat into its skin, so it would run. Running, it was still uncomfortable, so it would stop. Standing, it was still uncomfortable, so it would lie down. Then it would jump up again, running to the underbrush, the tree hollow, never staying still. The Buddha said, "Monks and nuns, do you see that jackal this afternoon? Standing, it suffered. Running, it suffered. Sitting, it suffered. Lying down, it suffered. It blamed standing for its discomfort. It blamed sitting. It blamed running and lying down. It blamed the tree, the underbrush, and the cave. In fact, the problem was with none of those things. The problem was with his mange, which he carried in his skin, on his back. And Ajahn Chah went on to say that our mange is not understanding right view. Not understanding right view. So right view is the first fold of the Eightfold Path. And simply defined, right view is understanding the Four Noble Truths. Understanding dukkha, the origination of dukkha, the sensation of dukkha, and the path leading to the end of dukkha. So this little story about this wild dog epitomizes much of our experience, right? I mean, how many times have we left a relationship because that was what was causing our suffering? Left a job, left a situation, always seeking some way that was free of that suffering, free of that dukkha, not realizing that we were carrying it on our back. So the sense of the first step really is to take responsibility, not to quiet the sense of blaming outward, the projection outward. If you've ever done any therapy, this is often the first thing that the therapist works with you on. It's as if it's always your parents' fault, if it's always your boss's fault, your spouse's fault, your lover's fault. You never have this power, you never take your power back of how to take responsibility for yourself. So that this gets expanded in a very deep way with this practice. It's tricky also because blaming externally can be the same as blaming internally. When we say, it's because I'm such a lousy person, I'm so unworthy. So we have this sense of identification we take on. It's who we take ourselves to be. So part of the art of practice is to learn how to connect deeply with our suffering and our pain without projecting outward or inward, but just to clearly see it. That's why in the meditation we just practice meeting the breath simply, without an agenda, without trying to change it, to control it, but just to meet it very directly. The breath, that's a template for every aspect of your experience. This thought, this emotion, this painful sensation, this pleasant sensation, even the sense of you can all be met in the same way. It becomes more and more subtle. And in that clear meeting, we clearly see the nature of the problem. And as Tuari will explore next month, how we see the cause of that, the origination of that. And this becomes this foundation for clear action. Action that actually addresses this mange we carry on our back. So we become more attuned to this sense of dukkha. Often we think of dukkha as suffering. And last week I talked about maybe translating it a little differently so we don't overlook the more subtle qualities of suffering. Certainly there's these big overt qualities of much, much deep power, deep pain, deep sorrow, deep physical pain, and the reactivity with that. But there's also this very subtle quality of dukkha, this very subtle quality of separation, of lack of fulfillment, of lack of finally being at home. This is also dukkha. And so the more attuned we become to these qualities, it becomes our urgency and our energy to practice also grows. That's why we start with this first noble truth, is to see that, because that becomes the motivation. Because the compassion arises. The compassion that there is pain, there is suffering in this body, this mind. So tonight I'd like to explore these classically three types of dukkha. and to see how compassion really helps to motivate us on our practice. So these three aspects of dukkha. Dukkha is ordinary suffering, often called dukkha-dukkha. Dukkha is produced by change, and dukkha as conditioned states. So these three elements of dukkha, these three descriptions we'll explore. So this first one, dukkha as ordinary suffering, or dukkha-dukkha. So according to Buddhist myth, this is what started the Buddha on his path, that he lived a life of much comfort. You know, there was a sense of getting rid of anyone who was ill or sick out of his view. So he went through life with a sense that everyone's young and healthy and beautiful, handsome. That's how he experienced his surroundings, because he was very sheltered. You know, he had different palaces depending on the weather and to shift from one season to in the next. And then one day he happens to go outside of the palace in the comfort of that zone. And he sees someone who's sick. And he's riding with his charioteer and says, "What's wrong with this person?" Because he's never seen anyone sick in his whole life. And his friend says, "Yeah, he's sick." And he says, "Does that happen to everyone?" And yes. "Will that happen to me?" And so this is a big shock, having never seen anyone sick, to realize that he is subject to this also. The next day, going out and seeing someone who's old, whose teeth have fallen out, and he's in shock, the Buddha's in shock that this has happened, and even more shocked that this has happened to everyone who lives long enough, and that will happen to him if he lives long enough. And the next day, going out and seeing someone who has died, and it's the funeral procession. And does this happen to everyone? Does it happen to me? Will it? And just this messenger, these heavenly messengers, because this sense of suffering that he was so sheltered from became the seed for his practice. And the next day he found a recluse of someone who's practicing, and that inspired him to find his own way through this suffering. So don't, you know, to acknowledge that, what brought us to practice often was this quality of suffering. And often what keeps us in practice is this sense of suffering and the realization that there is a way out. There is a pathway of freedom. So suffering, this first category of ordinary suffering, of dukkha-dukkha, much of it's inherent with having a human body, right? We will age, we'll get sick, we will die, we'll have aches, we'll physical discomfort. So everyone would experience this. Sometimes we get a sense that the Buddha was kind of beyond all that. Once he kind of became enlightened, it was just peaches and cream, or whatever you like to say. But, you know, the suttas, he talk about his back hurting, digestive problems. He died from digestive issues. So this physicality still applies. So this, but dukkha itself, there's this other element that's added. So we all have a certain measure of pain, some of us more than others, because of our ailments, because of our conditions, our injuries. But there's what we add to this extra part. This is really what Buddhism and the practice concerns itself with. And sometimes the majority of the pain is what's added to the bare experience. This is why some of the applications of like mindfulness in this country are so helpful and in the world with chronic pain. Because you have the pain, but then you have all the reactivity around the pain, the fear about what the pain will lead to. I had a friend who has chronic pain, and he said it was very helpful when he started to divorce his fear from the pain itself. So he could feel the sensations by themselves without the added fear to this. And I experienced this for myself when a number of years ago, I had a kidney stone attack. I was on a retreat, and so I was, you know, meditating with it and feeling it and just experiencing the intensity. And you know, it was okay. It was intense, but it was somewhat workable. And then a few months later, I had another attack, and that wasn't so workable, because there was the sensation, but added to that was all the fear from the last experience. how long that took, how much it cost, how the prolongedness of this, that whole thing was added to it. And I could see clearly, here's the sensation, which is intense, but much more was what I added to that. What is added to it, that is in, we explore in this realm of dukkha, how we can release that, not have to add that again and again to this moment's experience. This is what the homework points to, is seeing how much of this suffering is unavoidable and how much of it is added to this experience. You know, simple things. You stub your toe. You feel the pain of that. But how much do you rant and get very upset about it? That's all added to that moment's experience. The very first Dharma instructions I ever heard included this phrase that resistance times experience equals suffering by Shinzen Young, is the one who I heard it from. So resistance times experience equals suffering. Okay, so you have an experience and you have a lot of resistance toward it. It multiplies, so there's more of a sense of suffering. If there's an experience and there's no resistance, there's no suffering. So this simple phrase really caught my eye, my ear, because that meant, you know, in my life I was going through a very painful time. That even this painful time, much of this is caused by my own resistance. Right? So if I can release that resistance, is there a way through that suffering? That sense of compassion arose because, okay, there's pain here, but there's also this hope, this pathway of releasing that. Now, the sense of resistance, there's fundamentally two ways of resistance which really tie into the next two qualities of dukkha. So this is dukkha of ordinary suffering. The next is dukkha as produced by change. Dukkha as produced by change. So again, it's part of nature for things to always be in flux. Things are always being born and always dying, arising and passing away. You know, some things are a long duration, some are very short, but there's always a sense of flux. And if we're in harmony with that, there's no problem whatsoever. But this level of dukkha points to our relationship to that which is changing. If we take something that is changing and say, I'm happy as long as it doesn't change, another person, my own self, my body, the presidency, whatever it might be, as long as it stays a certain way, I'm happy. And when it changes, then I experience suffering. And it's not the fact that thing changed, but the way we were relating to it that caused our suffering. Do you get that? It's not the fact that it changed itself. That's in its nature. That's like saying, you know, I'm really upset the sun went down. That's the nature of it. Okay, but it's the relationship, that's the seed, that's what creates this dukkha, the sense of suffering around that. So all that we love, all that we cherish, all that we hold dear, eventually will pass away from us, or we will pass away from it, sometimes very gradually, sometimes very suddenly. So this is the sense of how do we relate to life itself. So can we start to relate to life with that sense of appreciating why it's here? It's like you're sitting and a butterfly lands in your hand, you appreciate that. And when it flies away, then you knew that was going to happen at some point. And so there's a grace with that experience. With this breath that arises, appreciating the subtlety, the comfort of that, the richness of the sensation, and as it fades, then it's gone. And the more we confuse something as being permanent when it's not, that's when we create suffering. With our bodies, our relationships, nothing's outside of this. Almost nothing. So this holding, this tightness of holding, this is moving into the second noble truth, the origination of suffering. So this sense of dukkha is produced by change. Does that mean we shouldn't grieve? We shouldn't experience loss and feel affected by that loss? I think this is very important to talk about, because some of the big distortions in this tradition and in spirituality in general is this image of what we should be like as a spiritual person. If I was spiritual, I wouldn't be reactive. I wouldn't be angry. I wouldn't be affected by this grief. And this is really a knot we tie ourselves into. Often with equanimity, the word equanimity is a sense of, okay, I have to be somehow balanced no matter what happens. And it becomes a problem when we use it to deny our human experience, deny what's arising in this moment. So the practice is simply, whatever arises, can we meet that? Can we meet that which is arising? If something arises and we say, oh, I should not be feeling that, I should not be having that arise, that's where that friction comes in. Noticing it arise is very different than acting from it. In fact, the more clearly we notice something arise, the less likely we're likely to unskillfully act from that. I believe Christ said that if you don't bring forth what's inside of you, it will destroy you. But if you bring forth what is inside, it will save you. This sense of grief and how we tend to hold that outside the spiritual path, we often look at the Buddha, just like we projected maybe he never experienced pain. Well, he certainly wouldn't experience grief. I mean, that's really an untaught person would feel that. But the Buddha did feel grief. There's a sutta where he talks about losing both of his most senior students, some of his deepest, dearest friends. And he said, I'm sitting here and I feel like the light has gone out of the world. I'm sitting here with 500 other people and I feel like I'm sitting alone. So let that in. That grief is part of being human. It's not outside of the spiritual, even for the Buddha. But what is added to this grief? What is added to that sense of loss? That's where we look. What is added to that? What is unnecessary? This is the added suffering. Now, impermanence isn't just about things falling away. It's also about things arising. And so as we're talking about suffering, there's also the arising of things which are unpleasant. Right? That's also part of dukkha, that things that arise are pleasant and they pass away, we experience suffering. Things arise which are unpleasant, we experience suffering. When they pass away, we feel relief of that. There's this one sutta where the Buddha has this realization. It's before he became the Buddha. He said, here I am, someone who's subject to change, constantly in flux, trying to find happiness in a world also constantly in change and constantly in flux. It was like an epiphany moment. He realized, this just doesn't make any sense. It's like two variables trying to find some connection. Right? What is outside of those variables? That is what he sought. That is what he's discovered. That's this path that we're exploring. So dukkha of change. The third type of dukkha is the dukkha of conditioned states. Now here we start to move into all the mental, emotional types of suffering. This, you know, the angst that we feel. This is really the core of what we add on to these first two. We feel a physical pain and there's this whole mental angst and worry that comes up with that. We feel an emotional pain. We feel some change, a loss, a grief, and there's all the emotional pain and thoughts that we add to that. So anxiety, worry, depression, obsessive thoughts, insecurities, fears, stress, doubt, compassion, or not compassion, judgment, spell check. Sneak that in. Comparison, that's right, I was going to say. You know, I could go on and on. Essentially, everything that you consider a problem of your mind is in this category. Everything that you consider is wrong about you, all your internal judgments, your lacks, all your judgments externally, this is all part of this sankhara dukkha. And it's conditioned because all this mind stuff that we so worry about, that we deal with constantly, is conditioned. It doesn't just happen haphazardly. We may not see the connections, but they are there. I often think to this day, I can hear a particular song, and it triggers a particular memory of being in middle school and waiting in the cafeteria line and all down to the greasy pizza they served us. And it's just this direct connection, because that one song has that connection. Okay? Same thing with someone might say something, and it could create this whole sense of reactivity, or this whole sense of melancholy, or a sense of love, or a sense of joy. It's conditioned, right? So we're always being kind of reactive to things. And when we act from that, we reinforce that conditioning. So being mindful, learning to be mindful, slows down this proliferation of this conditioned state, of this mind proliferation, prapancha. It starts to slow it down by, okay, connecting with the body, connecting with the breath. It starts to interrupt that pathway. That's why it's so emphasized. We often continue with this theme of projection on the Buddha. We think, okay, he had a physical body. He got sick. He had his back hurt. Okay, he felt grief when his two dearest friends died. But he probably never got mad. He probably never got scared or angry, right? But you know, you look in the suttas, I think they edited a lot of the ones out, to be honest, but there's someone he's telling somebody off. He's saying, you know, that you are stupid. That's a stupid thought. That's a stupid way to say that. You know, and he's just putting it out there. And I think that those suttas really help us realize he was just a human being that really understood deeply. Right? So not holding your anger outside of this, of the sacred, for bringing that in. It's not about what arises, but what happens the moment after something arises. Right? So a thought of anger may arise, but what do I do right after that? Do I kind of jump on that train, as Anushka often talks about, the thought train, and I follow that down and have more and more thoughts of anger and action, and I write an angry email and rant and rave and create this thing of destruction after me? Think about a certain individual who likes to tweet a lot. There's that kind of, in 10 years people won't know what I'm talking about. But that sense of you have an impulse and you act on it, that's actually reinforcing that. It's making that groove deeper. But if we just meet that with stillness and connect with our bodies, with a sense of compassion, that interrupts that. It's a critical thing to practice in as many ways as you can, because that deepens and grows. So this dukkha of conditioned states, so there's all this mental proliferation, all this reactivity, and at the root of all this, and really at the root of all the dukkha, is this sense of self, this sense of me as an isolated, separate, lasting self. Because, you know, we look out and say, okay, I'm looking, I'm having this experience, I'm having this thought. And I can remember back 5 years ago or 5 minutes ago, I was also there, right? But if we were able to look very closely, we would see that sense of self arises, has an experience, and falls away. And then it arises again and falls away. If we were to go super slow motion, we could see the momentary arising and passing away. But like a connect the dot picture, we connect it. So it's, oh, this is all me. It's a continuous self. And sometimes that self experiences a lot of suffering, a lot of pain, sometimes a lot of joy, right? But it's all happening to this particular thing. If we look closely, a particular person, when we look closely, we see that there's actually lots of gaps in there. And it's actually being manufactured to meet each moment's experience. Even more correctly, it's not so much it meets the moment's experience, but the moment is creating it. The moment is creating it through our reactivity, through our patterns, through our conditioning. So this sense of how do we assume identity and ownership, this is very subtle, and it has this tremendous amount of momentum for most of us. And so that's why opening to dukkha is so important, because it creates this energy to start to look and see. Because it takes a lot of inertia to see, sense of urgency, a lot of sincerity, to be able to understand this sense of self. Because it's, by definition, so unconscious. So we have to have a very bright light to be able to see that, either through much sincere, intensive practice, or just a sincerity of heart to want to see, to want to understand. So the sense of self is really the cornerstone, the keystone of this whole well of dukkha. All these other dukkhas rely on that when we boil it down. The good news is once we understand that, these other dukkhas fall away. Because the sense of self is seen through, then there's not the reactivity that arises. There's not someone to be reactive with this experience. Sometimes this can feel just like a quality of this is resistance. This is a quality of being slightly removed, slightly distant, a sense of me observing. Even when you're very quiet in meditation, you're feeling the breath and everything's very soft and peaceful and clear, but there's still a sense of me observing versus simply the observation happening. So how do we see through the sense of self? It's important, it's not to realize it's not just a change of thinking or learning a new meditative technique. It's really the aim of all the techniques is to see this, to have this insight into self, to see through this illusion of self. In an example you may resonate with you is think back to a time when you were very convinced of something, you're very opinionated about something, that you knew it was right. You even saw so much that it wasn't so much your opinion, it was facts, it was the actual reality, it was the truth. And just how that felt, how strong that felt. And then that instant you forgot, something changed and you realized that you were actually mistaken, that this wasn't right at all. And then what happened there? There's this releasing of that strong opinionation, that sense of being right. That release is the movement from identification to the release of identification. From the investment in a sense of self into the loosening of that. Can be a very strong sense of that. But it goes more and more subtle. And it needs to become subtle to see the edges of that. Sometimes the suffering, we talked about how suffering creates this impulse to see and to grow on the path, to set foot on the path. Sometimes suffering is so intense, it actually allows us to see the path very quickly and very directly. For a few people this happens. There's a story of a nun in the Buddhist time, one of the most senior nuns. And before she became a nun, she ran off with someone, so she really upset her family because she eloped. She ran off and had a couple kids, and finally she decides to go make peace with her parents. And on the way, her husband gets sick, and they have to go back, and he ends up dying. So there's much grief from that. So she still wants to continue to make peace with her family. And on the way, there's a flood, a big storm, and she has to cross this big river with a newborn baby and a toddler. Right? So she crosses across, sets her toddler down, or newborn on one side, goes back to get the toddler. An eagle comes and grabs the newborn and takes it away. and she's screaming, and the toddler thinks she's calling and goes into the river and swept away and dies. So in a short distance period of time, she lost her husband and her two children. So she's devastated and finally goes to this village where her parents live and asks about them. And someone says, "Don't ask me about that." And so finally she perseveres, and they had both died in the storm. So everyone she loved in a short period of time had died. And in that moment, really, she lost her mind and wandered in rags. And the Buddha finally came across paths, and the Buddha said, "Recover your presence of mind." And in that moment, she was on the path. So this intense suffering was what shifted her to see through this illusion of self. It was too painful to maintain that. This is the terrible gift of dukkha at some times. Even in our modern times, two famous spiritual teachers, Eckhart Tolle and Byron Katie, both experienced tremendous suffering. And that's what led to their own awakening. I'm not suggesting you try to manufacture some suffering like this, but just to realize that it can be a gateway. Sometimes it's a small gateway, sometimes it's a very large gateway. So we start to see through the sense of self, we see how the suffering of claiming a self, claiming a point of identity, that subtle impulse does create all these qualities of dukkha. The reactivity to physical pain, to this body aging, the dukkha of change, the dukkha of conditioned states. That's the deep root of all of these. And as we touch into that, our hearts start to open in compassion for this. And if we start to see the gateway through that, then there's a tremendous energy that comes up for practicing. So let me see this for myself. Let me see where dukkha arises. Let me understand the origination of that dukkha. Let me see the sensation of that dukkha. And then naturally, we turn toward the Four Noble Truths. Not as an intellectual exercise, but really driven and directed by our understanding. And just like that dog, instead of running from here to there to try to ease the suffering, we clearly see what the suffering is. And we see the way through that. Let's just sit quietly for a moment or two and let those words settle. As we sit, know that right in this moment, there is dukkha. There's also the release of that dukkha. It's so close that sometimes we overlook it. All is asked is simply being still, simply being present with this moment, without having to form an opinion, an idea, without even having to form a person who is watching, who is seeing. And there's just the breath, just sound. Each moment, the whole path is available. All right, thank you for your attention. So I'd like to just say a few words about the practice and reflection for this week before we open to any comments or questions. So this week I invite you to become more sensitive to dukkha, to a sense of suffering. Now, it could be something that's very overtly suffering, you're crying, you're just in a lot of stress, or it could be simply you're a little uncomfortable, that you like the moment to be a little different than it is. You would prefer to be just a little warmer, or a little cooler, or a little more, whatever it might be, just that sense of, I need to kind of tweak the dial a little bit, adjust things a little bit. So this whole spectrum. So when you call your attention first, that okay, dukkha is here. There's this quality of suffering, subtle, not so subtle. And ask yourself, how much of this suffering right now is unavoidable? Is this, there's no option in feeling it, no option in experiencing it. And then how much of it is added to this? How much am I adding to it? So this is going to be the arena of a reactivity, a sense of, often it's going to be in the thoughts and the emotions. And just hold those questions. Just notice that there is suffering in this moment and that some of it is unnecessary. Some of it is added to this. And then touch in this quality of compassion, a sense of the caring that you are hurting, that this moment isn't perfect the way it is. And see if that doesn't create the desire to start to understand the cause of dukkha. Right? So we're kind of really setting the stage for next month as we move into understanding the cause. I'm going to hold it, just keep holding that as a question, not any answers. So we have a really experiential sense of the right of dukkha that's present and how there's something that we're adding to that dukkha. Would this be an exploration? So we have some time for any comments or questions about the talk or anything else. Yes.
Could you just clarify, Tim, the last thing you said when you used the word compassion? How much am I adding to the dukkha? And you kind of said, notice it with compassion?
Yes, so the grammar of this may be a little awkward. You know, basically, compassion is the quivering of the heart in response to pain or suffering. Right, so when you touch, okay, I'm feeling some discomfort here, some suffering. Let the heart also acknowledge that. So we're not just leading with the mind saying, oh, that's dukkha, I don't understand what that is. But there's a sense of the heart saying, oh, I'm letting this in, letting the fact in that there is suffering there. And the aspect of letting it in, to see, does that lead to a sense of wanting to do something about it, to understand it, to turn toward it? Yeah, so just it's an open-ended question just to really see what arises. And I'm sure there will be times when it's like the answer is no, I don't want to turn toward this. Other times that yes, there is an invitation toward it. Yes.
Night, which is where someone I care about is sick. So that's the fact. And I woke up in the night and there was a real feeling of suffering, myself suffering, because what I felt was that there was a whole frame of this worry around it. So the frame was all in my, was very head oriented.
Yeah.
The story that was the really thick.
Yes.
And I thought, well, this person is still sick, but I really need to do metta. You know, I just have to frame it in a different way. Mm. So I went to I just listened to a metta tape, and it made such a difference. And I still felt sorrow, because the person is still sick.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was a real qualitative difference in the feeling and the ability to be with it. Every time I kind of went to that whole story, that story frame, I could feel it approaching again.
Yeah.
It just was a real dead end, and that it was felt really a place I could stay if I was in more of the heart and metta. So I don't know if that, because you did say in the homework that it might help. And I felt it really did. I don't know about understanding the cause, because it wasn't like I was trying to understand the cause of. I was just feeling like it was a more alive, better place to be.
Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. I mean, that's exactly what I would hope the homework would entice, you know, or invite you to do. So just to repeat that for the our friends on the internet, a friend who's ill, and there's a sense of really caring for that person, and noticing how there's a kind of a thickness of the story around that, and connecting with the story itself created that situation to be very hard to deal with. It was just overwhelming. There was just so much suffering around that. And turning to metta transformed that, going out of the story into the heart. And so suddenly the concern was still there, the tenderness was still there, but there something was set aside. That's exactly what I was trying to explore, is that added on element is often in the story, in the cognitive. Because that's endless. And you can create this whole scenario, and then something else triggers a whole different scenario, and then you got two scenarios to worry about, and you think of a third, and then it's suddenly this huge thing that you're carrying. And metta is really this inclination to be turn toward experience, to sit next to be friendly toward this moment. And so by doing that, you transformed the whole thing. And in terms of understanding the cause, understanding that there's an unnecessary suffering is linked to the story, is linked to the investment in the thoughts, in the concepts. Right? And that's the understanding. And the release of that is through the heart, through stillness. Yeah, do it like she did it. Or your own way. Yes?
Can you say a little bit more about the sense of self and releasing the sense of self?
Okay. So the question is about saying more about the sense of self and the releasing the sense of self. Can you tell me a little bit more about the confusion so I can be more exact? So that sense of what was that a sense of? Okay, because you were following. You said,
I felt like I was understanding.
Right, and then suddenly you realized you weren't.
Yes, and it was when you talked about the sense of self, and I don't really understand how you made what that is exactly.
Okay.
And letting go.
Okay. Okay. Good. Thank you. So, the sense of self is, let's see if I can find a different way to talk about it that's more accessible for a moment. What's that?
Are you talking about the sense of
Yeah, it has different elements. I mean, in some ways it's easier to talk about, easier to notice kind of the expression of the self. Okay, that's often a sense of ownership. Wherever you say, okay, this is I, this is me, or this is mine. Okay, so, you know, whatever it might be, like that's your shirt, that's your car, these are your glasses. That sense of who that's referring to is that sense of self. It's this sense of perspective that when we kind of look out in the world, it's kind of like we're in this middle of this spider web, that we're looking out and seeing all these different experiences, right? I'm seeing this, I'm hearing that, feeling that, but it all comes back to this very center point. Okay, that's the sense of me, of that where I am located. But if you actually say, okay, that seems like that's pretty solid, right? There's this point where everything's coming back to, that's me. Right? It's me who's having this experience, me who's talking. But if you actually look inside and say, okay, and this is an invitation, you know, don't take my word for it, but say, okay, where exactly is that sense of self? Is it something that, okay, let's see, is it something I can actually touch, actually find a location, a locus of that sense of me? Okay, is it like this cup that I can actually feel it? So you start to look inside, okay, where's that sense of, okay, I'm feeling this. Okay, where's that I that I'm always talking about? Where is that located? And you start to see if there's a solidness in that. Right, so that's one way to kind of start to explore that. And that's how I really start to work with it, is in meditation, is noticing, okay, here I am feeling my breath. Okay, that's going great. It feels like I have a good relationship to it. Or I'm getting lost in thought, whatever it might be. But there's a sense of me observing that. Okay, so the sense of observation. So there's the experience and there's the observer, the witness. Right, so you get a sense of that, right? So what's behind the witness? Because if you know the witness is happening, there's something that's able to see the witnesses there. What is that? So you get quieter still and say, okay, where is that? Okay, and then you may get a more subtle quality witness. And you just keep getting softer and softer and quieter until there's a point where you see that there is, wherever you turn, there isn't a sense of concrete self. It's something that arises, it's functional, allows you to do your job, navigate life, but it's also really arising and passing away constantly. And when that, there's often a moment when you start to see that, when it falls away, and in that moment, you see that there's a sense of deep connection to all experience. There's a lack of separation. There's a complete intimacy. And there's a complete peace. And the same, also sometimes, full disclosure, sometimes the sense of self, you know, it's a little disconcerting when it realizes it's not so real. And so there's often some fear that comes up with that. But that just, it's kind of like this, it's like shifting a perspective. And so it can seem like it's very kind of far out and hard to describe, but it's also very simple. It's simply like the sense of looking at your hand foreground and shifting your gaze to the background. That's about how much effort it takes. Foreground and background. Foreground doesn't disappear, but the focus becomes much broader. And I think it's important to make it not a intellectual thing, but really something that you if you're curious about, just start to notice it. Okay, the I who just said that, where is that I? Does that help? Good. Yeah, thank you for that question. Yes.
In my own experience, I definitely can identify with the fear response. And it seems like my fear response churns up like intellectual objections or like understand. And I feel like I've kind of waffled between, you know, we'll let those go, and then a part of me that's like really like, wait, you know, how is it possible to like cultivate mental qualities like I want to be like goodwill without an abiding self. So, you know.
Yeah, so it has a very convincing argument.
Yeah, well, right. Yeah. It's like hard to look away because I'm like, wait, you know.
Yeah.
And especially because it's an agitating experience as yeah. well.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know. That's not really a question, but.
No, yeah, it's a good comment. So the comment is, you know, this relating to that sense of fear or just being unquiet about it, and how the mind often has arguments about why you need a sense of self to be able to look and to observe, and it becomes very kind of noisy. Does that kind of capture the? I think I missed.
The intellectual objection that I
intellectual
keep
objection.
Coming back
Yeah.
is the concept of like developing the parmi, specifically these mental qualities that I want to develop in myself, and the understanding of like how is it possible to cultivate something if the concept of me is not real? Like what?
Yeah.
Where is that cultivation happening?
Okay, nice. So especially with the sense of intellectual objection is if there's a trying to cultivate the paramis, is that possible without a me who's doing that? And what, you know, what happens if that's not present? And it's actually a really good question, because kind of embedded in our tradition are many instructions which kind of go from that sense of self, using that as, okay, you're trying to move this direction. And so sometimes it's very skillful. It's like you're kind of taking the whole bundle and you're kind of working this way, and you don't realize you're actually working to release things. Okay, so I think if I can say that in a better way, you may apply a lot of sincerity, a lot of diligence to some particular practice, and by actually doing that, you're starting to unhook the deep roots. So sometimes that's part of the practice. Sometimes, though, the assumption of self is not questioned as we're doing something. Because a sense of self would love to just continue to be a spiritual self and be an enlightened self and be a Buddhist self. And as long as I can kind of keep that, then, you know, it's all hunky-dory. And there's a sense of me having to act and have will to choose to do this. And that's why you have to be willing to be sensitive to that sense of disquiet or even fear, because that's actually going beyond the known self. There's something else that moves beyond will, behind self-will. And that's where we have to go into more of a sense of surrender, a sense of trust, and see how the paramis may just simply arise of their own accord. We can incline ourselves that way, but they arise of their own accord. Yeah.
Like, just keep going.
Yeah. There's a faith of just, I'm just going to keep practicing this way. Yeah. Good. Yes.
This might be dovetailing off into a different direction, but that kind of opens the door for the question I'm trying to form. Just for myself, I've been going through a period of change in a lot of ways. Realizing how much everything I do is driven by fear.
Yeah.
How do you let that go?
Yeah, so feeling that sense of everything is driven by fear, and how to let that go. Okay, so this fear sounds different than this other fear we were just talking about. So just to acknowledge that. I mean, fear is often has a wisdom to it, and listening to that wisdom is saying, okay, why is there not a sense of safety in this experience? And sometimes the lack of safety touches some very tender places in us, you know, from how we were raised, our relationships, our deepest hurts. So don't worry about getting rid of fear, but a sense of tending to that deep pain. allowing that compassion to come in. So that you're not trying to force yourself to be lack of fear, but to really see that, okay, well, can I attend to this deep hurt, this deep pain? And then I think you'll find that sense of fear starts to soften in many of those areas. But don't try to force yourself through the fear, you know, before you're ready. It just seems like there is a lot of tenderness that's needed at this point. Yeah. Thank you. Anything else at this time? And you're welcome to come up and talk if you want afterwards. Right, anyone else have any comments or questions? Thank you for your sincerity, and thank you for the questions. And it always takes a level of courage to be able to ask a question and to put yourself out there, and it really is a service to everyone as well as yourself to flesh out the teachings to help clarify it, hopefully. So we have a few announcements from Peter Hummel.